Oyunga and Wandia, this question of a failure of imagination. I know Marilyn Kamuru said the same in the first webinar. And my question would be, is it a failure of imagination? Is it a limited imagination? So you imagine the next thing you can, and then perhaps a little bit later, you want to expand that imagination. The third question I would put into just into the discussion is who's failing to imagine? Wandia Oyunga, who wants to go next?
So, yeah, I also got when Ngala mentioned failure of imagination, I realize it's also something I said a lot, you know, about our state of being as a nation. But then as you talked about it, I started thinking a little bit more deep about it. I realized actually what it is not really a failure of imagination, because one of the things you realize, if for example, you're in a position of a curator or somebody who's working with grassroots movements, you realize that half the problem is that those in positions sort of like in positions of power or authority to create change are really bad listeners, you know. So we come with this sort of predetermined solutions and we're just hoping you'll endorse them. So we're giving you literally it's multiple choice examinations, you know. If you think outside of this three multiple choices that we give you, then there's no conversation. So what I see is a lot of what perhaps I would call a suppression of imagination. And this seems to be almost legislated, almost becomes a matter of policy, is that we just suppress imagination. It becomes just too, it's almost too radical. It's almost too wild. It's as though you ask a child, what do you want to be? And they say something that's completely out of your scope. And you immediately want to diagnose the child has a problem. What do you mean you want to be a herdsman, you know? that's you're going to private school. Why would that even be an ambition? You know, so I think there's a way, and I'm sorry if I'm going to sort of go back to the point of trauma. I think for me, the reason why we suppress imagination, because that's become the next question, is that why are we so afraid of this alternative thinking? Why are we so afraid of this sort of, we have this sort of grandiose thinking possibilities of how we could be, but every time it comes up, we suppress it. And the suppression has happened so often to the point, and when Andy expresses this frustration quite frequently, the point of you dare speak and people just, they call you out. You just imagine, just talking big, you know, like what? Those are just thoughts. You just have ideas. You can just, and the Met Fund of intellectuals for a very long time, you know, or cultural artists. And if anybody ever came up with a grand idea, you just told, those are grand ideas. Be realistic. Vitu kwa ground is different, as we would say in Kenya, you know? So it comes back to that. So this, I'd like to sort of say that perhaps this, perhaps suggest, you know, because this is just an opinion, really. This suppression comes from trauma. And listen, this is my own examination of the problem, because as you have positioned it for us, is then beyond blaming the politician, beyond saying, okay, these are the problems. We as individual citizens in sort of with interested in sort of creating this sort of change, how can we participate? And in order for me to participate critically within my sphere of influence, at least as a writer and as an editor and a curator, is to fundamentally understand why I keep on stuck in this recurring problem. This idea that if an idea like the elephant, for example, you know, the idea that we could create an independent media platform that's open to all ideas. Why is it that at some point we feel a need to suppress it, you know, that we can only expand at this level? And even if we're to imagine ourselves, we can only imagine ourselves in comparison to, say, a Western media platform. The idea that we could be actually the standard of the world in terms of how we do media becomes just something, but we almost instinctively suppress. The moment we enter into a world stage, we almost instinctively suppress it. And I think this is just a symptom of trauma, because we have just developed an adaptive behavior where it's almost like a tall poppy syndrome of where when you get to become almost, you've been too clever, you know, you guys are thinking about things that this be real, we always told be realistic. And the school system does that perfectly. Yeah. They ask you a series of questions. If you break the mold, you're told to come back to operate within the syllabus. There's somebody who was having a discussion here.
Because I don't want to say a lot about what you're saying, because I really agree with you, but I was just trying to remind you of this concept of the ideology of order, which I think has been written about and theorized by Yes Asuna Odhiambo, maybe to add into your maybe the origin of this kind of ethos is also from the colonial state. I don't know what you think about.
Before you do that, Oyunga, come in. Ngala, can you just say a little bit more so that everybody's on the same table when you talk about the ideology of order? What do you mean?
Because Oyunga is talking really about this kind of Kenyan sense of like not rocking the boat, right? So if you're talking about a settler colony that was ruled by are very few, actually, privileged elites, right? Mm-hmm. So actually, the question is, how are they able to do that? 75 years to rule over, you know, I think the population of Kenya in 1948 was maybe 4 million. How do you explain how the colonial state survived all those decades? It is sort of like these cultural practices of suppressing imagination, of valorizing order, and of making people to become scared of alternatives, right? Mm. So basically, to keep people in their place, and this was made very possible with a state which was basically an alliance of mostly big men, and who chose a very careful reading of culture and tradition to justify most of these cultural practices of not thinking outside the box. You know, there's a very nice academic paper. I always remember the title says, "We've always done it like this, except for a few details," right? So there's also a very careful reading of culture. Don't question, because it has always been done like this. But if you actually look at the history, there are a few details in which, you know, things were not as they are being presented. So yes, I just wanted to add that.
Thank you. Go ahead, Oyunga.
Yeah, thanks, Gala. Actually, it's a very good, I didn't think of it that way, actually. So thanks, you gave me some more reading there as well. Yeah, so, and I see basically suppression comes from, I think if you look at it sort of at an individual level, is that the colonial state became very good at sort of targeting behavior. And there was a way in which they sort of enforced this idea of integration. And if anybody then did not sort of fit within this integration, it's almost like the way they would deal with, you say, when they deal with behavioral, they put mice in a cage and you go towards one end, you want a response, they give you a reward of sugar, and they don't want to go to the other end, they give an electric shock. And if you think about it from the terms of the totality of society, that's exactly what happened. Yeah? Those who tried to go out were just given electric shock for so long. The point of all you had to do was just literally lift up the rod and everybody stayed in line, you know? And done consistently through very ingenious ways of an education system, that we've been unable to basically unravel ourselves from this sort of bind. So at least with that understanding, then perhaps maybe it behooves us then to think of like what do we do next? You know, because it's very easy to get fixated on the problem, and we can be there for a very long time. You know. How then do we teach ourselves and those who come after us to see differently? But more importantly, how do we teach ourselves to heal? Because if we don't particularly heal, then the same sort of traps that brought us to these things are very easy to manipulate. And in a way, sometimes when I look at the way sort of the political class operates in Kenya, it's almost sometimes you think of like a dial. It's like people can just dial it up, you know. It's like people, with society, Nairobi becomes a perfect example of our stresses are so well organized that somebody can literally just dial it up. All I have to do is just block a certain highway in Nairobi, and I can dial up the stress literally in hours in Nairobi, and there'll be consequences with it. So unless we sort of cultivated a committed group of people, people within society, and people at least with that awareness, and encourage them to help us see these problems, to help us see ourselves. Because in seeing ourselves, then there's a possibility of actually healing, you know? And as long as we sort of adapt around what is obviously a trauma, carried on, and we can adapt around it, and we do that very well. We can intellectualize it almost to death, you know? But beyond that, you know, we've got to find ways of healing and going beyond it. And it starts, of course, as individual quests. But ultimately, once you've figured out as yourself, it behooves you then to share it. And I guess that's what then centers the culture of movement in this country, in terms of like what's really going to change us as a people is how we exercise these tools of culture to reimagine ourselves.
So I want to ask the same question. I mean, continue the conversation with Wandia, but Wandia, I want to tweak this a little bit. If what Ngala and Oyunga are saying is something you don't totally disagree with, arguably, a constitution is that attempt where people get to a place And they say enough is enough, right? Angala, the only, I actually think that when you think about in the greater scheme of things, we were only colonized 1920 to 1960s, 40 years. And somewhere along that place, people said, you know what, we are done. We're not going to agree to this. We're not going to. So there's people somehow imagine it differently. They organize differently. We can go into the nuances of that. There's a constitution, for better or for worse, that governs this new, the new space. We enter into a space of independence in whatever form. And then people start to reform that, they write it and then they say, no. We need to tweak it. And they tweak it and tweak it and tweak it until people say, no, this isn't working. I always say, we usually talk about the journey of constitutionalism. We say the 90s, but you read Willy Mutunga and we realize actually it began before that with a smaller group of people. But arguably in 1990, we start again as another, and then we go through a journey of 20 years. We come up with another constitution. And now we're just basically looking at it and saying that looked like a good idea, but some would argue we need to tweak some things about it. And so that's what we are doing. And so it brings us back again to this question, what is a constitution? And in your mind, Oyunga has said, we need to now, we need to leverage the power of culture. We need to do all this so that we can get to a place of constitutionalism. But I guess the counter argument to that, which is what the BBI proponents are giving us, is that, but we don't want to do that until we've got the constitution right, right? So let's tweak things now so that we don't work on something that we know is already broken. Let's mend it and then work on what Oyunga is asking us to do. So whatever you think of the BBI, is there a merit in that argument? Because at the end, I'm asking the relationship between a constitution and the soul of a nation.
I think the constitution is sort of like what I was saying. It's our bottom line. What are the basic principles that will guide us? So when one of the major lies about BBI was the idea that the constitution is responsible for all our problems and they will be solved when we tweak around with the constitution. And that was not true. I think the question of whether our constitution is perfect or not doesn't arise, because it's people who make things happen. And we all agreed on this document. So what was supposed to have been done was that the politicians were supposed to interpret the spirit of the people that came through the constitution. But what they have done is to fetishize the constitution and make the constitution replace the people. And to say it is only when the constitution is tweaked around and things work that things will work, they are lying. And this is another problem that we have had with the colonial state. Because what I noticed, something that I learned throughout the BBI discussion, is that anytime the political class, and sorry to say a good section of the middle class, when things are not working as they cannot work with this kind of arrangement, they technologize the problem. They say, oh, the problem is this article, this verse, this chapter, this, they reduce the problem to such a small manageable thing and then present it to the Kenyan people and say, the reason devolution is not working is because there's something wrong with the way the constitution assigned assigned resources. But what people were saying is that, no, if you are a real politician, who is reading from the spirit of the people, from what the people say they want, then a word of law should not be standing in the way between you and the thing that you need to do as the elected representative. So when the politicians are saying we need to tweak this so that it works, they are fetishizing the constitution. They are making the constitution replace us. And they are refusing to listen to us. And in fact, part of my ambivalence about the court ruling, which I think was a great ruling, was that we had said these things. We had said them in open forum, but the politicians were not willing to listen to the people until it came from a court of law. And they do that because they have masters elsewhere. Their donors are not going to say anything unless it's in a court ruling. Because, the West recognizes courts. But if we say the same thing that the judges are saying, the politicians ignore us. because we are not we are not an institution. And for me, that is where the problem is, and it's a problem of imagination and education. We are just not able to go beyond institutions. We're not able to look at issues and see what is the human thing to do. What is the soulful thing to do? You know, like this case we've been talking about, the children miss a bus and the teacher says, I don't care, go away. And the children trek until, you know, for kilometers and kilometers and they're lost. I mean, what kind of country are we? Do we need the Ministry of Education to write for us a rule about that, about how to treat children humanely when they come late to school? I mean, and this is how, I don't know what the British did to us, but they suppressed our ability to go beyond the rules. We stick to institutions like they are gods. We don't question them. And when somebody says, well, let's imagine beyond the institutions, there are rhetorical ways to make sure that that doesn't happen. So you're told, you know, vitu kwa ground ni different. You know, why are you wasting time thinking, you know, does it put food on the table? There are all these rhetorical strategies, or what Keguro Masharia called political vernaculars, that make sure that we never speak beyond the institution. And that's where we have failed. So politicians are lying to us when they say that the issue is the constitution. The issue is them. They lack political imagination. They lack legitimacy among the people. They lack a soul. And so they want to blame the letters of the law for their inability to function. And I also wanted to say that part of this problem comes from the stories we tell about ourselves. For me, when I read the history of Kenya from different places, I'm so amazed by the richness of our history and our resistance. You know, everywhere in Kenya, there was a major resistance against colonial rule. But those are not the stories we tell. We tell the stories of Kau, Kanu, Kadu crossing the floor, I don't know, first president, second president statue. And that's the limitation of our history. So because our history is so, our historical consciousness is really, really limited, then we are not able to imagine beyond what the institutions tell us. And that's why, or that is what facilitates politicians to come and tell us, oh no, whatever failures I have, it has nothing to do with my leadership, it has nothing to do with ideas, it has nothing to do with the fact that Kenyans are not allowed to imagine, oh, it's the constitution. And then you know what the media does and the education system, sorry to say, what they do is that they hype up these technological solutions. So we start looking at we look at the what clause, we start even looking at verbs and pronouns, as we saw during the appeal. We start looking at small technical details, like when we would go to the media, we would be told, no, show us the line, show us where it is written before you can say anything. That limitation of imagination is what facilitates this lie that all our problems can be reduced to the Constitution. I think the Constitution has given us a fairly rigorous framework with which to work with. And we have to do the imagination and say, how do we translate the spirit of what people fought for? How do we translate it into daily life? That requires imagination, and that's what is being fought.
So I'm hearing this, you know, this idea of the limitation of imagination. I love that, what you brought in, this question of, you know, we're sticking to order and to rules. I think in the last conversation, Daisy Amdani highlighted the fact that, you know, when the Constitution says that 15%, not less than 15% goes to the counties, you don't need to change the Constitution to say now, not less can also mean, you know, as much as 30. right? But we're sticking to the language, to the letter, without allowing ourselves to imagine what are the possibilities beyond this. And I like this idea of this constitution as an agreement that governs our relationships, a covenant that we have with one another, that before we start to talk about tweaking, first of all, are we even holding on to, are we even starting? Yeah. I think that came out of the last conversation. Are we even first doing what we can do with what we have, the agreement that we have, before we amend it? I do want to get to that question of, so what? How does this, how does the constitution, if we allowed ourselves to imagine, we allowed ourselves to think about the lived experience, which is what culture really is, how does that translate into our lives? But before I do that, I want to go to, we've got quite a number of questions that are coming up. I want to ask people to please forgive me if I don't focus on the questions that go over the conversations that we had last time. And so I do see, Michael Omondi, that you've asked us to talk about inclusivity in the BBI. And if we have time at the end of this, we'll come back to that. But really the last conversation, the third conversation, looked at the question of inclusivity at quite some length. So let me put that on the side for now. And I'm going to just look at Babua Ayundo. The first question that is up on the Q&A asks if the panelists in general, do you share Ernest Renan's thesis in the essay entitled, What is a Nation? And he's citing from that particular essay, a nation is a soul, a spiritual principle. And if you share that idea, it is, then what Renan goes on to say is that critical to nation formation is the possession of a common, Therefore, critical to nation formation is the possession in common of a rich legacy of memories. The other is present consent, the desire to live together, the desire to continue to invest in the heritage that we have jointly received, right? So it's a consent, it's an agreement, and then we say, let's continue to share. So I'm going to put that question out there. And then I also want to bring that, Oyunga, if you want to start thinking about that aspect, Babu also asks in connection with that, can a people who are collectively traumatized form a functioning nation? If we share this history, we've agreed to live together, but we've been collectively traumatized. Can we therefore share a functioning nation? Or would we just simply reproduce our trauma in durable governance systems? So what needs to happen? You've talked about us needing to do some things. Do you want to think a little bit further on what needs to happen or change for a traumatized people to form a functioning nation? You've told us we need to do something. Could you think a little bit more about that? So Wandia and Ngala, I'm going to ask you to think with Babu on the question of the nation as a soul and as a spiritual principle. Do you agree with that? Do you disagree with that? How would you add to that thought?
I agree with that. And I agree with Renan's perspective on what a nation is or should be composed by. I think we sort of touched on that at the beginning of this conversation. Mm-hmm. I also don't feel that throughout our discussion that there's disagreement amongst all of us whether, you know, Kenya could be considered as a nation or not. I think we're very clear on this kind of definitions. So then the question becomes, and it's a question I asked initially, is, so if you don't have a nation, so what, right? How do you create a sort of liberal democratic system that creates a very meaningful and functioning concept of citizenship? Right, so that despite your identity, you are always assured of your rights as a citizen and as a member of a state called Kenya. Right, and I think maybe these are the questions that usually are asked during constitution making processes that maybe in Kenya we have not kind of properly grappled with. You know, the nation as a concept. In human history is also not a very old concept as well. So there is no point of fetishizing, if you like, the concept of the nation as if only a nation can function properly as a sort of political community. And to relate that answer to my answer to the next question, which was, can collective trauma create a nation? And say, absolutely. I mean, and not only can collective trauma create a sense of a nation, it can, that nation that's created by collective trauma can also cause trauma as a whole. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would encourage you to go back to Nazi Germany to look for examples of that. But then again, the question still remains, whether or not we have a nation, how do we conceive of our idea around citizenship? Who is a citizen? Why are they a citizen? And what rights are accorded to them as a citizen? The problem usually arises when some people are denied citizenship rights due to their, you know, perceived identities. And this is where this thing always becomes a problem. So how can we imagine a state that serves or can work for all, even in a state where there are multiple nations or multiple ethnicities?
Thank you very much, Gala. Wandia, did I hear you starting to come in?
Yeah, I was going to say I'm also not that attached to a nation. I am attached to humanity. And I feel that's where I feel Kenya has dropped the ball. We just don't relate to each other as human beings. We, you know, because when you think of it really, if somebody who is you, if we are saying the Ubuntu, I am because we are. If another Kenyan somewhere in this country is suffering, it should matter to all of us. But that's what we don't have because we've been told, no, that doesn't matter to you because you're different because of your identity. I think we need to establish our humanity outside of the nation so that the nation becomes the structure where we all respect everybody's dignity and guarantee everybody's dignity within this geographical space we call Kenya. I'm not saying that the nation is not important, but I've reached a point where I'm just like, if we can't even treat each other decently, you know, what nation can we really have? Like, really? And then on the question of trauma, I think, yes, we can become a nation because we are bound by our common trauma. I mean, that's how people find solidarity, by fighting against the same common enemy. And even when you think of cultures and ethnicities, they came together because they had to live in a certain environment. So they are working together to live in that environment, built a common language, a common history. It brought them together. But I think what is more important is that healing together is what would bind us. If we can just find a way of celebrating each other, celebrating the histories that are still alienated from the national consciousness. I wish we would, you know, have sort of like a circulation of, you know, when we celebrate our national holidays, it's not simply where the president goes, but we say today, this time we're going to do the history of this county. What are the histories there? And we do it for a week, for a month. We keep telling Kenyans, these are the histories from this area. And we do it all, we go all around like that so that we know each other intimately. But it's not even knowing each other, so that it is guiding our national consciousness. What our problem is that whatever makes us social, whatever makes us national is so controlled. I think it's Oyunga who said, the people in power are just not listening to us because there are so many good stories about us from different areas of Kenya that never go beyond the county, that never go beyond the belligerent politician, that never reach our history books, that never reach the national holidays. That's what we need to break through so that we all understand and know one another and celebrate one another. For me, that's what the nation would be, But I feel that part of the problem is that our humanity has been battered. It has been battered by trauma at different levels, the ideological, the spiritual, the educational, and then of course the physical through force of the state. So restoring humanity for me is the fundamental thing that we have to do if we want to be a nation.
Wandia, that gives me a good segue to Oyunga. Oyunga, as you come in, so when Wandia was speaking, I thought about not just celebrating who we are. And I agree with you, there are so many good stories that we just miss out on because we always go back to the same old, but also the stories of pain, the stories of trauma, the stories of hurt, and asking ourselves, what does this really, really mean? Aikwe Ama has a term I go back to all the time, which is called, you know, he uses the term celebration with an R. And he says that these gatherings should be about us thinking about what does that mean? I remember watching the premiere of Judy Kibinge's film Scarred, which looks at the Wagala massacre, and all of us who were gathered in the space as we were watching it, and people really hearing before the film, they also had people who are survivors and people from that community coming and speaking about not just what happened, but the impact on them all these years later. And for those of you who don't know the film Scarred, the reason it's called Scarred is that after the Wagala massacre happened, and you know that we've been talking already about this thing of suppression of people's voices and imagination, people were not allowed to talk about it. And so people had to find underground ways of keeping the memory alive, including songs and other cultural forms of production. But for me, the thing that was most touching was that in that film, you see people burying their bodies to show you the scars, because that's the only thing they have as evidence that this happened to them. And it was how many of us in that auditorium who are not from that area who said we did not know. Even when we knew about the Wagala massacre, we had not understood the depth of the trauma and of the pain and how it has continued to be carried on. And people saying, therefore, what does this mean going forward? We cannot just say, okay, now we know and you know we'll go home and we'll forget about it. But what does it mean going forward? And I remember someone like Irungu Houghton trying to remind people every year, saying, let's fast on that day. Not that my fasting as a person helps those people, but it reminds me of that I need to care about these people and we need to do something about their trauma. So I want Oyunga for you to take us into this question of trauma, how it relates to everything we're talking about, and bring in a comment by Kamau Mwiga, who says, let's talk about how being emotionally vulnerable about our traumas lies outside what is considered proper Kenyan masculinity, or what we like to say to each other, wacha umama. And I want to add that not just in terms of a gendered community, but also how often our faith communities would say, be strong, right? So don't cry, don't show any pain. How often people within, you know, whether, you know, if you're educated, we don't wail and cry at funerals or at events like that. You know, we are strong, going back to that that order, you know, the very British stiff upper lip. And how do we get beyond that?